This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. I have a favorite Vermont amphibian. I mean, who doesn't have one? It's the eastern newt. In the spring, you can see these newts in all three life cycle stages in one patch of forest. The adults, green speckled aquatics, swimming around in vernal pools and swampy areas. The eggs laid by those adults in big glutinous piles around reeds and cattails. And then the much more exciting juveniles. Known as red efts, the juveniles are a bright oxidized color with lighter colored spots outlined in black that look like they could glow in the dark. I even saw a bunch of efts this morning on my daily dog walk in the woods. Now, my favorite Vermont reptile, because again, who doesn't have a favorite reptile, is the timber rattlesnake. Until I moved back to Vermont 6 years ago, I didn't even know we had rattlesnakes. It wasn't something we learned about in elementary school. But this summer, I had the opportunity to join a group led by fish and wildlife biologist Doug Blodgett to check on the health of Vermont's rattlesnake population.
I'm pretty sure this is a female, and it might be pregnant or gravid. I don't see evidence of lesions or anything, but we'll digitally photograph it, and then we'll be able to blow that up and take a much closer look without bothering it.
So she's letting us know.
Yeah, so she knows we're here, and she's just telling us, okay, I'm over here. Yeah, that looks like a nice pregnant female there. Okay, let's back off a little bit.
Biologists are very concerned about snake fungal disease, a new illness that is devastating rattlesnake populations around the country. It's been found in Vermont, and they're trying to determine exactly how many snakes are affected. Today on the program, we're going to learn about many of Vermont's 40 species of reptiles and amphibians. And if you have a favorite, you can share it with us on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Or call in with your herpetology questions, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Jim Andrews joins us now. He's coordinator of the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas. Nice to have you back, Jim.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So snake fungal disease, as I mentioned, this is something that's fairly new. It affects more than just rattlesnakes. And in some places out in the Midwest, it's really devastating populations. How much of a concern is it for Vermont snakes at this point?
Well, I think it's a big concern, but it's very early in the process, our process of knowing exactly how widespread that disease is and really what the impacts on populations are here. In New Hampshire, as you probably know, they have a really small rattlesnake population.
I mean, ours is pretty small, a couple hundred.
We're talking maybe
smaller,
a dozen snakes total. And when a disease like this moves in, I mean, it can have a devastating impact. What the impact will be here, we don't yet know. Maybe this is a disease that's been here for a while. Maybe this is a disease that is working in combination with something else that's stressing the immune systems of these snakes. It's early yet here to know how much we should worry about this disease, but I'm glad we're aware of it and we need to be watching it.
Is it affecting any other snake species in Vermont? Because it is affecting other snake species elsewhere.
Yeah, we've seen it in some of our other snake species. I've seen a rat snake, commonly called a black snake, down in western Rutland County, that looked pretty ill. We've seen a couple other snakes. I saw a ribbon snake that looked like it might have that fungal infection. So we've seen it, but snakes, like humans, have diseases. The question is, what's the impact on the population? Is it significant? Will it drop the population? And that's something we still need to learn. But yeah, we've seen it.
Some people, you know, when we start to talk about these animal fungal diseases, it's hard not to think about problems that bees are having, that frogs are having, bat diseases. I mean, certainly that's of high interest here in Vermont. Is something like snake fungal disease on that same type of list, or is that there a concern that it might be this huge population devastator?
I think in some areas of the country where the snake populations are even more compromised than they are here, it is probably at that level in terms of concern. I don't think that we are yet there in Vermont. We just don't know that much about what impact it's really having. We've seen the disease, but we don't know what impact it's having on population. So it's still early, though. In terms of looking at the broad environmental impacts that we have as humans in terms of moving diseases around on the landscape that might not have been here before, or perhaps combining stressors, certain diseases and other factors, whether that be habitat change or habitat fragmentation or other threats to snake populations, and then putting that together with a disease that in combination maybe a small population can't overcome.
What about our frogs? I mean, frogs are another type of animal that's been having a lot of problems around the world.
Well, yeah, we've seen tremendous declines in amphibian populations worldwide, and much of that has been attributed to chytrid fungus. And chytrid is a fungus that, one of our colleagues in Quebec took a look at specimens of frogs that had been collected and were in museums to see if chytrid was a disease that we had had here back in the 50s and 60s. And he found out that it was a disease that we've had. And at first our thinking was that, well, okay, maybe this is kind of a reverse of some of the problems we've seen before. Maybe this is a disease that we had and that our amphibians had some resistance to, but that got exported around the world to other places. And I think there's some truth in that. Our bullfrogs have been exported all over the place for frog flakes. And many people are not happy about that. Many of the places where they've depleted local populations, the introduction of bullfrogs. But they're native here. But more recently, we found different strains of that disease. We found local strains, but we've also found an African strain. And it looks like the African strain is the strain that has the most impact on populations. We haven't seen the declines locally that some people have. There was a recent paper, though, that looked at declines in even relatively common species over the last decade or so. And they were seeing about a 10% decline in even the more common species. And this kind of decline that they're talking about is not in the size of a population, but in the amount of ponds that are appropriate habitat that were actually colonized. And they were seeing fewer and fewer ponds that were colonized by the species that they once had. So, yeah, we have real concerns. We are a mobile species. And we move lots of things around on our feet and our clothes. And in this case, African clawed frog, which was used for research and for pregnancy tests, was moved all over the country, came from Africa.
How was it used for pregnancy tests?
You're going to have to talk to somebody else. I think,
what a strange thing.
I think that some... Boy, I'm going out on a limb here a little bit, but something from, I think, maybe the woman's urine was added to the frogs, and then if it stimulated production of eggs, then that showed pregnancy.
Pregnancy in a human.
Huh. I mean, we've gotten beyond that test.
Thankfully. We'll try to find an article, and if we can, we'll put it up on the Vermont Edition Facebook page.
Get the details on that, not for me.
Jim, as we look at populations, we've got a lot of listeners who want to weigh in as well. And our number, by the way, is 1-800-639-2211. Dave wrote in to say there has been a severe decline in frog and toad populations around our property. He didn't say where he was from, though. Wood frogs have nearly disappeared. I've seen only 3 toads all summer. No mating songs in nearby ponds. Any info on local population declines?
Well, we're monitoring amphibians through an organization called the Vermont Monitoring Cooperative on Mount Mansfield and in the Lybrook Wilderness Region. We also have a private organization, Colby Hill Ecological Preserve, privately funded, where we're monitoring populations in Lincoln. And we see declines. It's not unusual for us to see a local decline and then jump over and check one of these other sites and see that, no, things are fine here. So it's not unusual to have localized declines. Okay, what might have happened? You might have had, I think winter kill this far north is a significant source of mortality. If we don't have good snow cover and we have cold temperatures and you're a wood frog who has evolved to freeze and then thaw in the leaf litter, which is an amazing thing. Heart stops, breathing stops. We have four species of frogs that can do that. But you can only tolerate temperatures down to about 20 degrees. And if you don't have snow cover and the temperature gets really cold, then your local population can disappear. Or what if breeding habitat changes a little bit? What if a pond gradually fills in? What if a pond drains? What if you have some nesting owls or hawks move into your neighborhood that have some kids to feed? There's lots of local factors. And so I hear that. I mean, there was a winter back, I think it was maybe 87, 88, where we had huge declines across the state. But at the same time, we lost our rose bushes. We lost a lot of half-hardy plants that we had in our yards because the depth of freeze. We lost garter snakes because the dens froze. So there can be local weather events. There can be local rain events. Dens can fill with rain and then freeze. But I would say across the board, I have not seen the kind of decline that this person is mentioning.
So how helpful is it to have people's observations when it can be really different in your backyard than it is in somebody else's backyard? I mean, Dave, I have a toad who every night is out in front of our porch light.
Yeah.
And we didn't have it last year. So do you, is it helpful to have people observing what's going on around them?
I always like to hear what people are observing, when they're hearing amphibians call, when they're seeing snakes move, if they think they're seeing fewer or more, timing of egg laying. That kind of data is really useful. It's a small state, but it's a large enough state for one herpetologist, me, to be gathering information from. And I'm easy to find online, VermontHerpAtlas.org.
And we have a link to that at vpr.net if people are driving or you haven't had a chance to write that down. Yeah.
Or if people don't want to send in forms, they can just send me an email or give me a call. But I'm happy to hear about those things. But local changes, I mean, it's good to be aware of them and think about them, but it doesn't necessarily represent what's going on over a larger area. But that said, there are some real threats that we're concerned about in terms of populations of reptiles and amphibians over the long term.
Like what? Habitat loss?
Well, habitat loss is always a big one. We tend to treat land as if it's a consumable, renewable resource. And we are all the time building new housing lots and parking lots and new roads and et cetera, et cetera. And the figures that back in the 80s when everything was booming, the average consumption per year of habitat was 10 square miles in Vermont. 10 square miles per year was developed. And it's easy enough for people to kind of picture that image of a limited amount of land. And if you're consuming land that is finite, I mean, it's like going to the bank and thinking, well, we're just going to continually take money out and there's a fixed amount of money in the bank. And most of our conservation efforts have been figuring out essentially how to live on less money so that we could just take less money out of the bank and make that money last longer and longer and longer. But we're still consuming land. I mean, that rate slowed down as we got into the 2000s. It slowed down to about 7.5 square miles per year. And I would bet, though I don't have the figures, that dropped substantially as the recession hit. But the point is that when we talk about sustainability, if we continue to consume and alter habitat, we will see results. There will be fewer populations, and some species will disappear, and ecosystems will be compromised. And we have to decide how much of a compromise we're willing to accept.
We're talking with Jim Andrews, herpetologist and coordinator of the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas. And listeners, we'd love to have your questions about these native Vermonters as well. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Getting some people sending their favorites in. Our own VPR's John Dillon says, my favorite reptile is the wood turtle, very rare and long-lived, found in the wetlands below my house in Middlesex. And Virginia posted on our Facebook page that she loves turtles. She says they're so mysterious and each and every one is gorgeous. It's been said that all the wisdom in the world is written in the shells of turtles, but to read it, you have to get all the turtles in one place. Let us know what your favorite reptiles and amphibians are, or again, what questions you have. You can post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. I'm talking today with Jim Andrews, coordinator of the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas, and we're learning some interesting facts about some of the state's 40 species. If you want help with a frog ID or snake information, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Eben is calling in from Panton. Hi, Eben. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. I'd just like to start by saying I love them all. I don't have a favorite. But my story, my experience is my wife and I bought 13 acres in Panton a number of years ago, and we have slowly been letting go ourselves of an idea, an expectation of manicuring of a yard, which has ultimately led me, we don't have a rototiller on our farm, and we don't have any mechanized mowing devices. I do all of our mowing with a hand scythe. And the life, the all sorts of life, insect life and reptilian life, has really rebounded. And I was saying in the phone queue before this that I recently built an art studio here, and in springtime and early summer we had tree frogs all over. And I really feel I'm calling to encourage people to turn their lawns into meadows and stop putting carbon in the air with lawn mowing. And you will see the results of, should someone want this in their backyard, so much wildlife you almost don't know what to do with it. My latest little treasure story was this summer, as I'm learning how to make hay with hand mowing, I came across a frog I haven't seen since I was a child, but it was a beautiful, the size of a bullfrog, but it was a leopard frog, and I just haven't seen them in a long time. So if that means anything to the practice of not grinding up all of your wildlife with lawnmowers, it pays dividends to me, I'll tell you.
Eben, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate that. What a cool sighting as well. Let's hear from James in Middlebury. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering how big the snapping turtles in Vermont get. And what would be some of the other diet that they might eat?
Sure. We like to keep track of the sizes of different turtles and snakes and frogs and salamanders and record sizes. And we have some of that information that we've put online. But for the snapping turtles, you hear regularly stories of people who tell you about wheelbarrow-size snapping turtles, and I think these go along the lines of a lot of fish stories. but in terms of what we've measured, the largest carapace length, the shell, the back shell, has been about 18.5 inches. And a lot of people are going to think, oh, geez, I've seen turtles twice that size. Well, with a snapping turtle, the total turtle – once you add in the neck and the tail, the neck will be almost 18 inches long itself, and the tail might be 15 inches or so there, so that you have a creature when it's moving that looks to be the size of a small alligator. But about 18.5 inches has been the longest. And I'm sure there's some bigger ones out there and would love to hear about them, but I'd love to hear about them in conjunction with somebody who actually put a measuring device.
Yes, but be careful when you're doing that.
you can certainly handle snapping turtles, and we do get a lot of questions about that. If you if you grab them at the back of the shell or by the rear legs.
Not the tail.
Not the tail, the rear legs. Then you're staying far enough back so that you can handle them and stay out of trouble. And if I could respond a little bit to the first caller as well. That definitely is an issue.
Mowing
and over manicuring. And it's one of the things we're dealing with at a Nature Conservancy site where we're trying to keep an area open because it's the open habitat that a lot of snakes and leopard frogs are wanting to use. But that area is not going to stay open unless we get in there occasionally and cut it. And modern farming equipment is just so fast and so efficient that anybody who's checked bales knows that you can find anything from small mammals to deer, fawns in those bales. So absolutely, and weed whackers. You mow your lawn and wildlife hides along the edges of your house and the garden, et cetera, et cetera. And then you go through with a weed whacker. And many reptiles and amphibians are killed there as well. Even somebody like myself who is doing everything they can to make sure it doesn't happen, it still happens occasionally. So absolutely, letting your yards grow or hand cutting would be a tremendous benefit to a wide variety of wildlife.
We are talking today about Vermont's reptiles and amphibians with Jim Andrews, a herpetologist. And listeners, again, if you have questions, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Now, one of the most important habitats in Vermont, particularly for our amphibian friends, is the vernal pool. Steve Fascio, a conservation biologist at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, joins us for a few moments now to talk about a vernal pool mapping project the center is working on. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Jane.
So tell us a little bit, just briefly, about vernal pools. They're small, they're fed by runoff and snow melt in the springtime, not always around. Why are they so important?
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, they support a number of amphibians that use them for breeding. And we're not talking about a high diversity of amphibians, but four species or so, three species of salamander and one frog in particular, the wood frog, that really depend on these temporary pools for breeding. Not that they can't breed in other types of wetlands, but they really depend on the vernal pools to a large extent around the state. And the main reason is because vernal pools don't support fish populations, and these amphibians that evolved in breeding in these temporary pools don't have any defenses against predatory fish, like bullfrogs or green frogs or newts do, that breed in permanent wetlands. So vernal pools are critical for these amphibians, as well as a wide variety of insect and invertebrate life.
And you're mapping these vernal pools, but I understand you've gotten to, what, about 15 to 20% of what you estimate are 3,000 or 4,000 vernal pools in Vermont?
Right. Well, what we did was we kind of took a two-step approach. The first thing we did was we mapped potential pools using existing aerial photographs that the State Wetlands Office has of the entire state. And these are photographs that are flown by an airplane in these north to south lines. So the photographs are paired. So you look at two photographs at a time with a stereoscope, which enlarges the image and also allows you to see topography. So you can see the earth in three dimensions, which is very helpful to find these small pools. So we mapped out what we thought were vernal pools using these photographs for the whole state. We mapped about 4,000 of those. And then the next step was to enlist a bunch of citizen science volunteers. We offered training workshops around the state and got a bunch of people out there to try to field verify a proportion of those 4,000 or so potential pools that we mapped. And as you said, we ground truthed about 15% of those 4,000 pools.
And are you still looking for volunteers to help you map the rest of them?
We're still actively, although the training workshops and the mapping of the potential pools with the aerial photograph, all that work is done. But we're still interested in getting volunteers to go out and ground truth places where we have landowner permission to do that.
To what end? What do you hope to do by having a map of vernal pools?
Well, it's like any other wetland or something you want to conserve. You first have to know where they are before you can take any steps to conserve them or develop any kind of conservation strategies. So all of our other wetlands are all mapped. We have the National Wetlands Inventory maps, and we have the Vermont Wetland Inventory maps that map our smaller our other types of wetlands. But vernal pools slip through the cracks because they're so small and difficult to locate. So we want to develop this map so that you know, we can take steps either through Act 250 to protect vernal pools if any kind of development is proposed where there's a vernal pool, as well as to just know where they are in order to better understand the distribution of some of these species that breed in them.
Steve Fascio is a conservation biologist at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. He's been telling us about a vernal pool mapping project. Steve, thanks so much.
Sure.
And listeners, we're talking today about reptiles and amphibians. Lots of listeners weighing in with their questions. AJ in Essex emailed in to say, my kids have a couple of questions. So Evelyn, age 4, asks, where do the reptiles go in the winter, and why do snakes always move so slow? Jim Andrews?
Not all snakes move slowly. Those people who have been out in the fields with me looking for racers, North American racers, had the experience of trying to catch those snakes, and they are very fast. But in terms of in the winter, that's a great question. Snakes are ectotherms. That means they're solar heated. They get their heat from the environment, and there's not a lot of heat available in the winter, and so they have to make sure they don't freeze. We don't have any freeze-tolerant snakes that we're aware of. So they have to find a place that is not going to reach freezing temperatures. Now, for a widespread snake like a garter snake, that might be underneath the garage, or it might be in an old cistern or a woodchuck burrow. But for some species, there are very limited places that are appropriate for overwintering. Timber rattlesnakes. It's a southern species at the northern extent of its range, and so it needs the warmest microclimate, a vertical face or at least a sloping face that is very open and gets a lot of sun from the south and the west and has loose rock that is deep enough so that they can get down in the crevices of that rock to get deep enough without freezing. There are a few other species that are kind of interesting, such as our little red-bellied snake, which can overwinter in anthills. The ants aerate and loosen the soil, and it's a tiny little snake, so it can move down into the openings created by the ants and get deep enough so that it doesn't freeze.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
AJ's other child, Alex, age 6, asks, how do the frogs manage to go from an egg to a full-grown frog in our short summer? And why is our lawn overrun with tiny, tiny frogs and toads this week?
Not all frogs do manage to go from egg to frog in one summer. This far north, the bigger frogs that start breeding later don't have enough time to make it. So they go through one winter or perhaps two as a tadpole. And then at about this time in the second year or the third year, depending on how warm the water is and how much food they have, then they start resorbing their tail, which is just an amazing thing to think that they break down their tail and recycle it and use it in other parts of their bodies. And once that process has started, then they leave those ponds. And right now is when we're seeing all the little amphibians coming out of those ponds. Some of them have been, like I say, in those ponds for a couple of years. Others, like wood frogs and spotted salamanders, have only been in that pond this year. So they had to be feeding voraciously and getting up to size and up to speed. And late summer, early fall is when you can see sometimes hundreds, sometimes thousands of these small amphibians. But most of these will be just the bottom of the food chain. They are just tremendously important food sources. As sad as that might be for the little frogs and salamanders, they're providing food for a tremendous variety of other species out there, from ducks and herons and raccoons and foxes and coyotes and hawks. So a lot of those guys are just right now appearing. And if you live near a wetland, you have a wetland on your property, you may be seeing all the little toads, which are smaller than a dime. They're just tiny. Little spring peepers are showing up. The leopard frogs can be just tremendously abundant in old fields. So it's a neat thing to watch.
We actually got a note from Jane in St. George who says, this time of year is always a thrill, but for the same reason daily hikes in the woods become a macro obstacle course, I feel I have to constantly keep my eyes lowered to the ground around my feet as minuscule wood frogs, no larger than the nail of my pinky, hop about. Their numbers reach up to 50 for each walk, not counting those that may dive under my foot too late for me to step aside. So apparently not just ducks and raccoons are also mortality due to humans.
And particularly after a rain. I mean, they're amphibians. So they have semi-permeable skin, and they are at great risk of drying out. So they hide, and they have been hiding for the last week or two. And this last little rain that we had has allowed them to come to the surface and move around without risk of drying out. And then as soon as it gets dry again, they're disappearing and hiding.
Let's go to Christina calling in from Marshfield. Hi, Christina. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about timber rattlesnakes. I thought I saw one late at night up on a mountain in Waitsfield a few years ago. And the moon was out. I was in a red pine plantation, so it was really open and there was some visibility. I didn't get close enough to see if it had a rattle, but the end of the tail was very black. It had the diamond pattern on its back and what looked like a diamond-shaped head. And I'm wondering if that could be part of their range. And if it's not part of their range, what other snake could look like the timber rattler?
Jim?
The snake that is most often confused with the timber rattler is the milk snake. As a matter of fact, all of the records of timber rattlesnakes that we've tracked down where we were able to find the snake outside of the known range have been milk snakes. Milk snakes in particular, because they are one of the snakes that will rattle. They'll shake their tails, they'll rattle, they'll coil. They have a pad. Most of us are used to looking at garter snakes, which are striped, and instead we're going to see blotches that could look triangular down the back. And so timber rattlesnakes are very, very localized. We would love to find a population or more populations surviving in other areas of the state, but we only know of the Western Rutland County populations now. So in Waitsfield, by far the most likely species that you're looking at would be a milk snake.
Jim, I want to ask you if you have a favorite reptile or amphibian, because I shared mine at the top of the show.
I think probably gray tree frog. It just has such character. And for a frog, it has a movable neck. It can meet your eye. It varies tremendously in color. If you're holding them, they hang on to you, and they can cling to your hands, fingers, and walk around on your body. And right now, they're fooling a lot of people because the little gray tree frogs are not gray. They're just a beautiful emerald green. I think it's just a neat frog.
And then before I let you go, you want to school me in something that I said right at the beginning of the show about my favorite amphibian, the eastern newt, which I said lays these sort of masses of eggs, and you're telling me they don't. I have the wrong eggs I'm associating.
That's true. You mentioned large gelatinous masses, and if it's a large gelatinous mass, you probably were looking at a spotted salamander egg mass. The newts lay individual eggs that they attach to vegetation, and you'd have to look pretty hard to to find those eggs at all.
Well, I tell you what, next spring I'm going to go do that. I'm going to find them, and I'm going to take a picture, and I'm going to send it to you. And listeners, if you have more observations about reptiles and amphibians, Jim Andrews is the coordinator of the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas. We have a link up at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Jim, thank you so much for being on the program.
And thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're going to check in with VPR's John Dillon on complications in bringing new wind projects online in the Northeast Kingdom. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A new wind development project in the Northeast Kingdom is running into snags. Concerns about the strength of the transmission grid in the area is raising doubts about the wisdom of erecting any new turbines. VPR's John Dillon has been reporting on this proposed project in Eden, Vermont, and he joins me now. Hi, John.
Hello, Jane.
So what is this developer hoping to build in Eden?
Well, it's a company called BNE out of Colebrook, Connecticut, and they want to put up six of these very large turbines, 3 megawatts apiece, for a total capacity of about 18 megawatts. And it's on the south end of the Lowell Range in Eden in an area called Bigelow Basin. So I don't know if you've been up to see Green Mountain Power's project, 21 turbines along the Lowell Ridgeline. This would be sort of on the south end of that, sort of a continuation along that ridgeline. And what's perhaps unique about this proposal is that it's a Connecticut company looking to use a location in Vermont to meet Connecticut's renewable energy goals. That state has what they call a renewable portfolio standard, in which utilities have to buy a certain amount of power from renewable sources. They've recently upped that standard, and they put out an RFP, a request for proposal, for developers to submit to the state to meet that standard to supply utilities with renewable energy. So this would be a potential project to meet those goals.
Huh. How far along are they in the project?
Well, they've already measured the wind up there. They've done that earlier over the past several years. And they've submitted the deadline for the RFP in Connecticut was in the beginning of August. They've filed for that. Connecticut's now got to review it to see if it meets their standards for project viability and the ability to provide this power to Connecticut. Not sure of that deadline, but the developer, the chairman of the company, told me that once that process is complete, if they've cleared that hurdle, they'll then apply to the state of Vermont for a certificate of public good. So he said that could be sometime in 2014.
But they're already running into some issues with the strength of the transmission grid and other people saying this project isn't going to fly. Remind us why the strength of the grid is an issue up there.
Well, a wind project isn't much use unless it can get the electricity out of the area. And the issue with wind in the Northeast Kingdom is that's where the wind is strong, but it's also where the transmission grid is weak. So two projects up there have already run into this problem with the grid. First Wind in Sheffield and Green Mountain Power's Lowell project have both been, the term of art is curtailed or cut back by the operator of the New England grid, basically because the transmission network was built for distributing electricity, not for handling major new sources of generation. It's an old system. It's an old network. The wires are literally too skinny for some of the transmission needs. So adding another big power source with this BNE project could be problematic. It could lead to curtailments of existing wind projects if it causes further disruption to the grid. And this concern was raised by Vermont Electric Co-op. Their CEO, David Hallquist, says his utility will oppose the Eden project if it advances further because of these transmission issues.
But Green Mountain Power has talked about installing what's called a synchronous condenser to help ensure that the power generated by that project, the Lowell Wind project, doesn't overload the grid. Couldn't Eden project developers do the same thing and sort of bypass the problem?
They could. I don't know the engineering at all well enough to say that a synchronous condenser could be the solution. The Eden developer would have to do what's called a system impact study to see what they would need to do. But it's a question of cost. Would they have the money? That would become part of the project cost. Would they have the money then to both upgrade the network and build the wind project? So, yes, there are solutions, but they're expensive.
Well, whose responsibility is it, John, to make sure that the connection to the grid is strong? I mean, the synchronous condenser, we're saying that would be the developer's responsibility. But does the state have a responsibility, ISO New England, the grid owners? I mean, who can make that connection stronger?
The kind of the rule of thumb is if a project, a transmission project, is needed for reliability to keep the lights on, that project cost is then shared among all customers in New England. So Vermont's share of those costs is usually around 4% of the overall transmission project. In the case of a project having an impact on the grid on its own, you know, causing its own disruption, that responsibility is the developer's. So they wouldn't be able to spread that out among other customers in New England if their project itself was causing the disruption.
If Vermont Yankee goes offline at some point, does that part of the conversation change about what is needed for reliability as we change to more renewables, you know?
That's a good question. The grid was built for basically, we're dealing with a transmission grid that was built for baseload. It hasn't yet been adapted to handle the intermittent nature of renewable electricity. And the other issue is that Vermont Yankee is so far away from where the grid constraints are now up in the Northeast Kingdom. So there could be issues posed by Vermont Yankee going online. That's been studied by the ISO. And they've said basically that those issues can be dealt with and it wouldn't require further upgrades to the grid.
John, as you well know and have reported quite extensively, our current administration and Governor Shumlin is very bullish on renewable energy. People may remember he was not in favor of putting a moratorium on new wind projects. It's part of Vermont's plan to have more renewables. But does it now seem likely that no new wind projects at the very least are going to be approved in the Northeast Kingdom until we get this transmission strengths issue worked out?
I think it's a significant hurdle for these projects. Another project up there, Seneca Mountain Wind, has transmission issues as well. So as I was mentioning, the issue is the age of the grid, what the grid was built for, and whether the technology can be adapted to assimilate these intermittent sources of power. So transmission, now developers are having to factor in the transmission constraints as well as, you know, do they have customers? Is the project environmentally friendly, et cetera? It's just one more thing that they have to look at, particularly in this area. It's also an issue up in rural Maine where the transmission grid just wasn't made to handle large-scale projects. So you're basically running into a situation where you have a grid that wasn't built for these things, and so the grid will have to be improved.
That's VPR's John Dillon. Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
And you can find all of John's reporting on wind projects at vpr.net. Springfield voters rejected a landlord ordinance. The Vermont Veterans Home will not lose its federal funding. Libraries in the state will launch a video conference service. Lawmakers approved new rules on motel stays for the homeless, and the Shoreland Commission worked to balance environmental and property rights. These were some of the voices in the news this week.
Some of the things that need to be fixed in a lot of these buildings aren't going to cost you $1,500, it's going to cost you tens of thousands. And as landlords, this isn't coming out of our pockets, this is coming out of our tenants' pockets.
The whole year we've been focusing on training, we've been looking at patient caseloads, and we've been getting everybody involved, sharing ideas, helping each other out. An example, you come in the morning, you know, the busy time is when we're feeding our residents, and you'll find maintenance folks out there helping the nurses deliver food to the patient.
We have folks that are working two and three jobs that don't have this type of capability in their homes, don't have to make choices between filling their fuel tank and buying an iPhone and so forth. So having the libraries provide the service to remain connected is going to be very important.
This is a big, big improvement over what had been originally proposed by the department. So we're happy for that. At the same time, we're only partway down the road here. We have got to address the problem of homelessness in Vermont.
The folks with the big checkbook have absolutely no problem, and we've seen that on Willoughby Lake. They thumb their nose at the regulations and just pay the fine. I'm concerned that the average person be able to enjoy their property without having a large checkbook.
And you'll find all of those stories linked at vpr.net. That's it for today. Monday on the program, new food safety laws will soon change the way farmers and producers operate in the state. The Federal Food and Drug Administration came to tour Vermont this week, and they got an earful from small-scale farmers who are worried about how the regulations might affect them. We'll talk about what the Food Safety Modernization Act might mean for state's agriculture and for food safety and food producers on Monday. And you can send your comments or questions to vermontedition@vpr.net. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistants from Annie Russell and Tim Johnson. Neil Charnoff directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Have a great weekend.